electric force that causes a current to flow in another nearby wire. Maxwell recognized that to make a complete and consistent set of equations for electricity and magnetism, he had to add an extra term to the equations, representing what he called a displacement current. He reasoned that moving charges, namely a current, produce a magnetic field, and moving charges represent one way to produce a changing electric field, since the field from each charge changes in space as the charge moves along. So maybe a changing electric field, one that gets stronger or weaker in a region with no charges in motion, could produce a magnetic field. Maxwell envisioned that if he hooked up two parallel plates to opposite poles of a battery, each plate would get charged with an opposite charge as the current flowed from the battery. This would produce a growing electric field between the plates and would also produce a magnetic field around the wires connected to the plates. For his equations to be completely consistent, Maxwell realized the increasing electric field between the plates should also produce a magnetic field in that empty space between the plates. And that field would be the same as any magnetic field produced by a real current flowing through the space between the plates. So Maxwell altered his equations by adding a new term, displacement current, to produce mathematical consistency. This term effectively behaved like an imaginary current flowing between the plates, producing a changing electric field identical in magnitude to the actual changing electric field in the empty space between the plates. It also was the same as the magnetic field that a real current would produce if it flowed between the plates. Such a magnetic field does in fact arise when you perform the experiment with parallel plates, as undergraduates demonstrate every day in physics laboratories around the world. Mathematical consistency and sound physical intuition generally pay off in physics. This subtle change in the equations may not seem like much, but its physical impact is profound. Once you remove real electric charges in the picture, it means that you can describe everything about electricity and magnetism entirely in terms of the hypothetical fields that Faraday had relied upon purely as a mental crutch. The connections between electricity and magnetism can thus be simply stated. A changing electric field produces a magnetic field. A changing magnetic field produces an electric field. Suddenly, the fields appear in the equations as real, physical objects in their own right, and not merely as a way to quantify the force between charges. Electricity and magnetism became inseparable. It is impossible to talk about electrical forces alone because, as I will shortly show, one person's electric force is another person's magnetic force, depending upon the circumstances of the observer and whether the field is changing in his frame of reference. We now refer to electromagnetism to describe these phenomena, for a good reason. After Maxwell, electricity and magnetism were no longer viewed as separate forces of nature. They were different manifestations of one and the same force. Maxwell published his complete set of equations in 1865 and later simplified them in his textbook of 1873. These would become famous as the four Maxwell's equations, which, admittedly rewritten in modern mathematical language, adorn the t-shirts of physics undergraduates around the world today. We can thus label 1873 as establishing the second great unification of physics, the first being Newton's recognition that the same force governed the motion of celestial bodies as governed falling apples on Earth. Begun with Oersted and Faraday's experimental discoveries, this towering achievement of the human intellect was completed by Maxwell, a mild-mannered young theoretical physicist from Scotland, exiled to England by the vicissitudes of academia. Gaining a new perspective on the cosmos is always, or should be, immensely satisfying. But science adds an additional and powerful benefit. New understanding also breeds tangible and testable consequences, and often immediately. So it was with Maxwell's unification, which now made Faraday's hypothetical fields literally as real as the nose on your face. Literally, because it turns out you couldn't see the nose on your face without them. Maxwell's genius didn't end just with codifying the principles of electromagnetism in elegant mathematical form. He used the mathematics to unravel the hidden nature of that most fundamental of all physical quantities, which had eluded the great natural philosophers from Plato to Newton, the most observable thing in nature, light. Consider the following thought experiment. Take an electrically charged object and jiggle it up and down. What happens as you do this? Look here at the provided PDF figure 3A. Well, an electric field surrounds a charge, and when you move the charge, the position of the field lines changes. But, according to Maxwell, this changing electric field will produce a magnetic field, which will point in and out of the paper as shown in the attached figure 3B. Here, the field line pointing into the paper has a cross, the back of an arrow, and that pointing out of the paper has a dot, the tip of an arrow. This field will flip direction as the charge changes the direction of its motion from upward to downward. But we should not stop there. If I keep jiggling the charged object, the electric field will keep changing, and so will the induced magnetic field. But a changing magnetic field will produce an electric field. Thus, there are new induced electric field lines which point vertically, changing from up to down as the magnetic field reverses its sign. I display the electric field line to the right only for lack of space, but the mirror image will be induced on the left side. See here the attached PDF figure 3C. But that changing electric field will in turn produce a changing magnetic field, which would exist farther out to the right and left of the diagram, and so on. Jiggling a charge produces a succession of disturbances in both electric and magnetic fields that propagate outward, with the change in each field acting as a source for the other, due to the rules of electromagnetism as Maxwell defined them. We can extend the picture shown in the previous images to a 3D image that captures the full nature of the changing as shown in the next figure, 3D. We see a wave of electric and magnetic disturbances, namely an electromagnetic wave moving outward, with electric and magnetic fields oscillating in space and time, and with the two fields oscillating in directions that are perpendicular to each other, and also the direction of the wave. Even before Maxwell had written down the final form of his equations, he showed that oscillating charges would produce an electromagnetic wave. But he did something far more significant. He calculated the speed of that wave in a beautiful and simple calculation that is probably my favorite derivation to show undergraduates. Here it is. We can quantify the strength of the electric force by measuring its magnitude between two charges whose magnitude we already know. The force is proportional to the product of the charges. Let's call the constant of proportionality A. Similarly, we can quantify the strength of the magnetic force between two electromagnets, each with a current of known magnitude. This force is proportional to the product of the currents. Let's call the constant of proportionality in this case B. Maxwell showed that the speed of an electromagnetic disturbance that emanates from an oscillating charge can be rendered precisely in terms of the measured strength of electricity and the measured strength of magnetism, which are determined by measuring the constants A and B in the laboratory. When you use the data then available for the measured strength of electricity and the measured strength of magnetism and plugged in the numbers, he derived speed of electromagnetic waves approximately equal to 311 million meters per second. A famous story claims that when Albert Einstein finished his general theory of relativity and compared its predictions for the orbit of Mercury to the measured numbers, he had heart palpitations. One can only imagine, then, the excitement that Maxwell must have had when he performed his calculation. For this number, which may seem arbitrary, was well known to him as the speed of light. In 1849, The French physicist Fizeau had measured the speed of light, an extremely difficult measurement back then, and had obtained speed of light approximately equal to 313 million meters per second. Given the accuracy available at the time, these two numbers are identical. We now know this number far more precisely as 299,792,458 meters per second, which is a key part of the modern definition of the meter. In his typical understated tone, Maxwell noted in 1862, when he first performed the calculation, quote, "We can scarcely avoid the conclusion that light consists in the transverse undulations of the same medium which is the cause of electric and magnetic phenomena," end quote. In other words, light is an electromagnetic wave. 2 years later, when he finally wrote his classic paper on electromagnetism, he added somewhat more confidently, quote, "Light is an electromagnetic disturbance propagated through the field according to electromagnetic laws," end quote. With these words, Maxwell appeared to have finally put to rest the 2,000-year-old mystery regarding the nature and origin of light. His result came, as great insights often do, as an unintended byproduct of other fundamental investigations. In this case, it was a byproduct of one of the most important theoretical advances in history, the unification of electricity and magnetism into a single, beautiful mathematical theory. Before Maxwell, the chief source of wisdom came from a faith in divinity via Genesis. Even Newton relied upon this source for understanding the origin of light. After 1862, however, everything changed. James Clerk Maxwell was deeply religious, and like Newton before him, his faith sometimes led him to make strange assertions about nature. Nevertheless, like the mythical character Prometheus before him, who stole fire from the gods and gave it to humans to use as a tool to forever change their civilization, so too Maxwell stole fire from the Judeo-Christian gods' first words and forever changed their meaning. Since 1873, generations of physics students have proudly proclaimed, "Maxwell wrote down his four equations and said, 'Let there be light.'" Chapter 4. There and back again. "He set the earth on its foundations. It can never be moved." Psalms 104, verse 5. When Galileo Galilei was being tried in 1633 for heresy for, quote, "holding as true the false doctrine taught by some that the sun is the center of the world," end quote, he allegedly muttered under his breath, in front of his church inquisitors, quote, "and yet it moves," end quote. With these words, his revolutionary nature once again sprang forth, in spite of his having been forced to publicly adhere to the archaic position that the earth was fixed. While the Vatican eventually capitulated on earth's motion, the poor god of the Psalms never got the news. This is somewhat perplexing since, as Galileo showed a year before the trial, a state of absolute rest is impossible to verify experimentally. Any experiment that you perform at rest, such as throwing a ball up in the air and catching it, will have an identical result if performed while moving at a constant speed, as, say, might happen while riding on an airplane in the absence of turbulence. No experiment you can perform on the plane, if its windows are closed, will tell you whether the plane is moving or standing still. While Galileo started the ball rolling, both literally and metaphorically, in 1632, it took another 273 years to fully lay to rest this issue. Issues, unlike objects, can be laid to rest. It would take Albert Einstein to do so. Einstein was not a revolutionary in the same sense as Galileo, if by this term one describes those who tear down the dictates of the authorities who came before them, as Galileo had done for Aristotle. Einstein did just the opposite. He knew that rules that had been established on the basis of experiment could not be easily tossed aside, and it was a mark of his genius that he didn't. This is so important, I want to repeat it for the benefit of those people who write me every week or so telling me that they have discovered a new theory that demonstrates everything we now think we know about the universe is wrong, and using Einstein as their exemplar to justify this possibility. Not only is your theory wrong, but you're doing Einstein a huge disservice. Rules that have been established on the basis of experiment cannot be easily tossed aside. Albert Einstein was born in 1879, the same year that James Clerk Maxwell died. It is tempting to suggest that their combined brilliance was too much for one simple planet to house at the same time. But it was just a coincidence, albeit a fortuitous one. If Maxwell hadn't preceded him, Einstein couldn't have been Einstein. He came from the first generation of young scientists who grew up wrestling with the new knowledge about light and electromagnetism that Faraday and Maxwell had generated. This was the true forefront of physics for young Turks such as Einstein near the end of the 19th century. Light was on everyone's mind. Even as a teenager, Einstein was astute enough to realize that Maxwell's beautiful results regarding the existence of electromagnetic waves presented a fundamental problem. They were inconsistent with the equally beautiful and well-established results of Galileo regarding the basic properties of motion produced 3 centuries earlier. Even before his epic battle with the Catholic Church over the motion of Earth, Galileo had argued that no experiment exists that can be performed by anyone to determine whether he or she is moving uniformly or standing still. But up until Galileo, a state of absolute rest was considered special. Aristotle had decided that all objects sought out the state of rest, and the Church decided that rest was so special that it should be the state of the center of the universe, namely the planet on which God had placed us. Like a number of Aristotle's assertions, although by no means all, this notion that a state of rest is special is quite intuitive. For those who like to quote Aristotle's wisdom when appealing to his prime mover argument for the existence of God, let us remember that he also claimed that women had a different number of teeth than men, presumably without bothering to check. Everything we see in our daily lives comes to rest. Everything that is, except the moon and the planets, which is perhaps one reason that these were felt to be special in antiquity, guided by angels or gods. However, every sense that we have that we are at rest is an illusion. In the example I gave earlier of throwing a ball up and catching it while you're in a moving plane, you will eventually be able to tell that your plane is moving when you feel the bouncing of turbulence. But even when the plane is on the tarmac, it is not at rest. The airport is moving with the Earth at about 30 kilometers per second around the sun, and the sun is moving about 200 kilometers per second around the galaxy, and so on. Galileo codified this with his famous assertion that the laws of physics are the same for all observers moving in a uniform state of motion, i.e., at a constant velocity in a straight line. Observers at rest are simply a special case, where the velocity is zero. By this he meant that there is no experiment you can perform on such an object that can tell you it is not at rest. When you look up in the air at an airplane, it is easy to see that it is moving relative to you. But there is no experiment you can perform on the ground or on the plane that will distinguish whether the ground on which you are standing is moving past the plane, or vice versa. While it seems remarkable that it took so long for anyone to recognize this fundamental fact about the world, it does defy most of our experience. Most, but not all. Galileo used examples of balls rolling down inclined planes to demonstrate that what previous philosophers thought was fundamental about the world, the retarding force of friction that makes things eventually settle at rest, was not fundamental at all, but rather masked an underlying reality. When balls roll down one plane and up another, Galileo noted, on smooth surfaces, the balls would rise back to the same height at which they started. But by considering balls rolling up planes of ever-decreasing incline, he showed that the balls would have to roll farther to reach their same original height. He then reasoned that if the second incline disappeared entirely, the balls would continue rolling at the same speed forever. This realization was profoundly important and fundamentally changed much about the way we think about the world. It is often simply called the law of inertia, and it set up Newton's law of motion, relating the magnitude of an external force to the observed acceleration of an object. Once Galileo recognized that it took no force to keep something moving at a constant velocity, Newton could make the natural leap to propose that it took a force to change its velocity. The heavens and the earth were no longer fundamentally different. The hidden reality underlying the motion of everyday objects also made clear that the unending motion of astronomical objects was not supernatural, setting the stage for Newton's universal law of gravity, further demoting the need for angels or other entities to play a role in the cosmos. Galileo's discovery was thus fundamental to establishing physics as we know it today. But so was Maxwell's later brilliant unification of electric and magnetic forces, which established the mathematical framework on which all of current theoretical physics is built. As Albert Einstein began his journey in this rich intellectual landscape, he quickly spied a deep and irreconcilable chasm running through it. Both Galileo and Maxwell could not be right at the same time. More than 20 years ago, when my daughter was an infant, I first began to think about how to explain the paradox that young Einstein struggled with, and a good example literally hit me on the head while driving her in my car. Galileo had demonstrated that as long as I am driving safely and at a constant speed and not accelerating suddenly, the laws of physics in our car should be indistinguishable from the laws of physics that would be measured in laboratories in the physics building to which I was driving to work. If my daughter was playing with a toy in the back seat, she could throw the toy up in the air and expect to catch it without any surprises. The intuition her body had built up to play at home would have served her well in the car. However, riding in the car did not lull her to sleep like many young children, but rather made her anxious and uncomfortable. During our trip, she got sick and projectile vomited, and the vomit followed a trajectory well described by Newton, with an initial speed of, say, 15 miles per hour, at a nice parabolic trajectory in the air, ending on the back of my head. Say my car was coasting to a red light at this time at a relatively slow speed, say 10 miles per hour. Someone on the ground watching all of this would see the vomit traveling at 25 miles per hour, the speed of the car relative to them, 10 miles per hour, plus the speed of the vomit, 15 miles per hour, and its trajectory would be well described by Newton again, with this higher speed, 25 miles per hour, as it traveled towards my now moving head. So far, so good. Here's the problem, however. Now that my daughter is older, she loves to drive. Say she is driving behind a friend's car and dials him on her cell phone, hands-free for safety, to tell him to turn right to get to the place they are both going. As she talks into the phone, electrons in the phone jiggle back and forth, producing an electromagnetic wave in the microwave band. That wave travels to the cell phone of her friend at the speed of light. Actually, it travels up to a satellite and then gets beamed back down to her friend, but let's ignore that complication for the moment, and is received in time for him to make the correct turn. Now, what would a person on the ground measure? Common sense would suggest that the microwave signal would travel from my daughter's car to her friend's car at a speed equal to the speed of light, as might be measured by a detector in my daughter's car, label it with the symbol C, plus the speed of the car. But common sense is deceptive precisely because it is based on common experience. In everyday life, we do not measure the time it takes light or microwaves to travel from one side of the room to another, or from one phone to a nearby phone. If common sense applied here, that would mean someone on the ground, with a sophisticated measuring apparatus, would measure the electrons in my daughter's phone jiggling back and forth and observe the emanation of a microwave signal which would be traveling at a speed C plus, say, 10 miles per hour. However, the great triumph of Maxwell was to show that he could calculate the speed of electromagnetic waves emanated by an oscillating charge purely by measuring the strength of electricity and magnetism. Therefore, if the person on the ground observed the waves having a speed C plus 10 miles per hour, then for that person, the strength of electricity and magnetism would have to be different from the values that my daughter would observe, for whom the waves were moving at a speed C. But Galileo tells us this is impossible. If the measured strength of electricity and magnetism differed between the two observers, then it would be possible to know who was moving and who was not, because the laws of physics, in this case electromagnetism, would take on different values for each observer. So, either Galileo or Maxwell had to be right, but not both of them. Perhaps because Galileo had been working when physics was more primitive, most physicists came down closer to the side of Maxwell. They decided that the universe must have some absolute rest frame and that Maxwell's calculations applied in that frame only. All observers moving with respect to that frame would measure electromagnetic waves to have a different speed relative to themselves than Maxwell had calculated. A long scientific tradition gave physical support to this idea. After all, if light was an electromagnetic disturbance, what was it a disturbance of? For thousands of years, philosophers had speculated about an ether, some invisible background material filling all of space, and it became natural to suspect that electromagnetic waves were traveling in this medium, just as sound waves travel in water or air. Electromagnetic waves would travel with some fixed, characteristic speed in this medium, the speed calculated by Maxwell, and observers moving with respect to this background would observe the waves as faster or slower, depending on their relative motion. While intuitively sensible, this notion was a cop-out, because if you think back to Maxwell's analysis, it would mean that these different observers in relative motion would measure the strength of electricity and magnetism to be different. Perhaps it was deemed to be acceptable because all speeds obtainable at the time were so small compared to the speed of light that any such differences would have been minute at best and would certainly have escaped detection. The actor Alan Alda once turned the tables on conventional wisdom at a public event I attended by saying that art requires hard work and science requires creativity. While both require both, what I like about his version is that it stresses the creative, artistic side of science. I would add to the statement that both endeavors require intellectual bravery. Creativity alone amounts to nothing if it is not implemented. Novel ideas generally stagnate and die without the courage to implement them. I bring this up here because perhaps the true mark of Einstein's genius was not his mathematical prowess, although, contrary to conventional wisdom, he was mathematically talented, but his creativity and his intellectual confidence, which fueled his persistence. The challenge that faced Einstein was how to accommodate two contradictory ideas. Throwing one out is the easy way. Figuring out a way to remove the contradiction required creativity. Einstein's solution was not complex, but that does not mean it was easy. I'm reminded of an apocryphal story about Christopher Columbus, who got a free drink at a bar before departing to find the New World by claiming he could balance an egg upright on top of the bar. After the barman accepted the bet, Columbus broke the tip off the egg and placed it easily upright in the bar. He never mentioned not cracking it, after all. Einstein's resolution of the Galileo-Maxwell paradox was not that different, because if both Maxwell and Galileo were right, then something else had to be broken to fix the picture. But what could it be? For both Maxwell and Galileo to be right required something that was clearly crazy. In the example I gave, both observers would have to measure the velocity of the microwave emitted by my daughter's cell phone to be the same relative to them, instead of measuring values differing by the speed of the car. However, Einstein asked himself an interesting question. What does it mean to measure the velocity of light after all? Velocity is determined by measuring the distance something travels in a certain time. So Einstein reasoned as follows. It is possible for two observers to measure the same speed for the microwave relative to each of them, as long as the distance each measures the rate of travel relative to themselves during a fixed time interval, say 1 second as measured by each of them in their own frame of reference, is the same. But this too is a little crazy. Consider the simpler example of the projectile vomit. Remember that in my frame, it travels from her mouth in the back seat to hit my head, say 3 feet away, in about 1/4 second. But for someone on the ground, the car is traveling at 10 miles per hour during this period, which is about 14.5 feet per second. Thus, for the person on the ground, in 1/4 second, the vomit travels about 3.6 feet plus 3 feet, or a total of 6.6 feet. Hence, for the two observers, the distances traveled by the vomit in the same time is noticeably different. How could it be that for the microwave, the distances both observers measure could be the same? The first hint that perhaps such craziness is possible is that electromagnetic waves travel so fast that in the time it takes the microwaves to get from one car to another, each car has moved hardly at all. Thus, any possible difference in measured distance traveled during this time for the two observers would be essentially imperceptible. But Einstein turned this argument around. He realized that both observers had not actually measured the distances traveled by the microwaves over human-scale distances, because the relevant times appropriate for light to travel over human-scale distances were so short that no one could have measured them at the time. And similarly, on human timescales, light would travel such large distances that no one could measure those distances directly either. Thus, who was to say that such crazy behavior couldn't really happen? The question then became, what is required for it to actually occur? Einstein reasoned that for this seemingly impossible result to be possible, the two different observers must measure distances and/or times differently from each other in just such a way that light, at least, would traverse the same measured distance in the same measured time for both observers. Thus, for example, it would be as if the observer on the ground in the vomit case were to measure the vomit traversing 6.6 feet, but would somehow also infer the time interval over which this happened to be larger than I would measure it inside my car, so that the inferred speed of the vomit would be the same relative to him as I measure it to be relative to me. Einstein then made the bold assertion that something like this does happen, that both Maxwell and Galileo were correct, and that all observers, regardless of their relative state of motion, would measure any light ray to travel at the same speed, c, relative to them. Of course, Einstein was a scientist, not a prophet, so he didn't just claim something outlandish on the basis of authority. He explored the consequences of his claim and made predictions that could be tested to verify it. In so doing, he moved the playing field of our story from the domain of light to the domain of intimate human experience. He'd not only forever changed the meaning of space and time, but also the very events that govern our lives. Chapter 5. A Stitch in Time. He stretcheth out the north over the empty place, and hangeth the earth upon nothing. Job, chapter 26, verse 7. The great epic stories of ancient Greece and Rome revolve around heroes such as Odysseus and Aeneas, who challenged the gods and often outwitted them. Things have not changed that much for more modern epic heroes. Einstein overcame thousands of years of misplaced human perception by showing that even the God of Spinoza could not impose his absolute will on space and time, and that each of us evades those imaginary shackles every time we look around us and view new wonders amid the stars above. Einstein emulated artistic geniuses such as Vincent van Gogh and reasoned with the parsimony of Ernest Hemingway. Van Gogh died 15 years before Einstein developed his ideas on space and time, but his paintings made it clear that our perceptions of the world are subjective. Picasso may have had the chutzpah to claim that he painted what he saw, even as he produced representations of disjointed people with body parts pointing in different directions. But Van Gogh's masterpieces demonstrate that the world can look very different to different people. So too, Einstein explicitly argued, for the first time as far as I know in the history of physics, that here and now are observer-dependent concepts and not universal ones. His argument was simple, based on the equally simple fact that we cannot be in two places at once. We are accustomed to feeling that we share the same reality with those around us because we appear to share the same experiences as we look about together. But that is an illusion created by the fast speed of light. When I observe something happening now, say a car crash down the street or two lovers kissing under a lamppost as I walk nearby, neither of these events happened now, but rather then. The light that enters my eye was reflected off the car or the people just a little bit earlier. Similarly, when I take a photo of a beautiful landscape, as I just did in Northern Ireland where I began writing this chapter, the scene I captured is not a scene merely spread out in space, but rather in space and time. The light from the distant pillared cliffs at Giant's Causeway, perhaps a kilometer away, left those cliffs well before, perhaps 30 millionths of a second before, the light from the people in the foreground scrambling over the hexagonal lava pods left to reach my camera at the same time. With this realization, Einstein asked himself what two events that one observer views as happening at the same time in two different locations would look like for another observer moving with respect to the first observer while the observations were being made. The example he considered involved a train because he lived in Switzerland at a time when a train was leaving about every 5 minutes for somewhere in the country from virtually any other place in the country. Imagine the picture shown in the attached PDF, figure 5A, in which lightning hits two points beside either end of a train that are equidistant from observer A, who is at rest with respect to these points, and observer B on a moving train who passes by A at the instant A later determines the lightning bolt struck. A little while later, A will see both lightning flashes reaching him at the same time. B, however, will have moved during this time. Therefore, the light wave bringing the information that a flash occurred on the right will already have passed B, and the light bringing the information of the flash on the left will not yet have reached him. B sees the light coming from either end of his train, and indeed the flash at the front end occurs before the flash at the rear end. Since he measures the light as traveling toward him at speed C, and since he is in the middle of his train, he concludes, therefore, that the right-hand flash must have occurred before the left-hand flash. Who is right here? Einstein had the temerity to suggest that both observers were right. If the speed of light were like other speeds, then B would of course see one wave before the other. But he would see them traveling toward him at different speeds. The one he was moving toward would be faster, and the one from which he was moving away would be slower. And he would therefore infer that the events happened at the same time. But because both light rays are measured by B to be traveling toward him at the same speed, C, the reality he infers is completely different. As Einstein pointed out, when defining what we mean by different physical quantities, measurement is everything. Imagining a reality that is independent of measurement might be an interesting philosophical exercise, but from a scientific perspective, it is a sterile line of inquiry. If both A and B are located at the same place at the same time, they must both measure the same thing at that instant. But if they are in remote locations, almost all bets are off. Every measurement that B can make tells him that the event at the forward end of his train happened before the next, while every measurement that A makes tells him that the events were simultaneous. Since neither A nor B can be at both places at the same time, their measurement of time at remote locations depends upon remote observations. And if those remote observations are built on interpreting what light from those events reveals, they will differ on their determination of which remote events are simultaneous, and they will both be correct. Here and now is only universal for here and now, not there and then. I wrote almost all bets are off for a reason. For as strange as the example I just gave might seem, it can actually be far stranger. Another observer, C, traveling on a train moving in the opposite direction from B on a third track beside A and B, will infer that the event on the left side, the forward part of his train, occurred before the event on the right-hand side. In other words, the order of events seen by the two observers, B and C, will be completely reversed. One person's before will be the other person's after. This presents a big apparent problem. In the world in which most of us believe we live, causes happen before effects. But if before and after can be observer-dependent, then what happens to cause and effect? Remarkably, the universe has a sort of built-in catch-22, which ends up ensuring that while we need to keep an open mind about reality, we don't have to keep it so open that our brains fall out, as the publisher of the New York Times used to say. In this case, Einstein demonstrated that a reversal of the time ordering of distant events brought about by the constancy of light is only possible if the events are far enough apart so that a light ray will take longer to travel between them than the inferred time difference between the two events. Then, if nothing could travel faster than light, which turns out to be another consequence of Einstein's effort to coordinate Galileo and Maxwell, no signal from one event could ever arrive in time to affect the other. So one event could not be the cause of the other. But what about two different events that occur sometime apart at the same place? Will different observers disagree about them? To analyze this situation, Einstein imagined an idealized clock on a train. The ticks of the clock occur each time a light ray sent from a clock on one side of the train reflects off a mirror located on the other side and returns to the clock on the original side of the train, as can be seen in the attached PDF 5B. Let us say each round trip, tick, is a millionth of a second. Now consider an observer on the ground watching the same round trip. Because the train is moving, the light ray travels on the trajectory shown in the attached figure 5C, with the clock and mirror having moved between the time of emission and reception. Clearly, this light ray traverses a greater distance relative to the observer on the ground than it does relative to the clock on the train. However, the light ray is measured to be traveling at the same speed C. Thus, the round trip takes longer. As a result, the 1 millionth of a second click of the clock on the train is observed on the ground to take, say, 2 millionths of a second. The clock on the train is therefore ticking at half the rate of a clock on the ground. Time has slowed down for the clock on the train. Stranger still, the effect is completely reciprocal. Someone aboard the train will observe a clock on the ground as ticking at half the rate of their clock on the train, as the figure would look identical for someone on the train watching a light travel between mirrors placed on the ground. This may make it seem like the slowing of clocks is merely an illusion, but once again, measurement equals reality. Although in this case, a little more subtly than for the case of simultaneity. To compare clocks later to see which, if any, of the observer's clocks has really slowed down, at least one of the observers will have to return to join the other. That observer will have to change his or her uniform motion, either by slowing down and reversing, or speeding up from apparent rest and catching up with the other observer. This makes the two observers no longer equivalent. It turns out that the observer who does the accelerating or decelerating will find, when she arrives back at the starting position, that she has actually aged far less than her counterpart, who has been in uniform motion during the whole time. This sounds like science fiction, and indeed it has provided the fodder for a great deal of science fiction, both good and bad, because in principle, it allows for precisely the kind of space travel around the galaxy that is envisaged in so many movies. There are a few rather significant glitches, however. While it does make it possible in principle for a spacecraft to travel around the galaxy in a single human lifetime, so that Jean-Luc Picard could have his Star Trek adventures, those back at Starfleet Command would have a hard time exerting command and control over any sort of federation. The mission of ships such as the USS Enterprise might be 5 years long for the crew on board, but each round trip from Earth to the center of the galaxy of a ship at near light speed would take 60,000 years or so as experienced by society back home. To make matters worse, it would take more fuel than there is mass in the galaxy to power a single such voyage, at least using conventional rockets of the type now in use. Nevertheless, science fiction woes aside, time dilation, as the relativistic slowing of clocks is called with regard to moving objects, is very much real and very much experienced every day here on Earth. At high-energy particle accelerators, such as the Large Hadron Collider, for example, we regularly accelerate elementary particles to speeds of 99.9999% of the speed of light and rely on the effects of relativity when exploring what happens. But even closer to home, relativistic time dilation has an impact. We on Earth are all bombarded every day by cosmic rays from space. If you had a Geiger counter and stood out in a field, the counter would click at a regular rate every few seconds, as it recorded the impact of high-energy particles called muons. These particles are produced where high-energy protons and cosmic rays smash into the atmosphere, producing a shower of other lighter particles, including muons, which are unstable, with a lifetime of about 1/1,000,000th of a second, and decay into electrons, and my favorite particles, neutrinos. If it weren't for time dilation, we would never detect these muon cosmic rays on Earth. Because a muon traveling at close to the speed of light for 1/1,000,000th of a second would cover about 300 meters before decaying. But the muons raining down on Earth make it 20 kilometers, or about 12.5 miles or so, from the upper atmosphere, in which they are produced, down to our Geiger counter. This is possible only if the muons' internal clocks, which prompt them to decay after 1/1,000,000th of a second or so, are ticking slowly relative to our clocks on Earth, 10 to 100 times more slowly than they would be if they were produced at rest here in a laboratory on Earth. The last implication of Einstein's realization that the speed of light must be constant for all observers appears even more paradoxical than the others, in part because it involves changing the physical behavior of objects we can see and touch. But it will also help carry us back to our beginnings to glimpse a new world beyond the confines of our normal earthbound imagination. The result is simply stated, even if the consequences may take some time to digest. When I'm carrying an object such as a ruler and moving fast compared to you, my ruler will be measured by you to be smaller than it is for me. I might measure it to be, say, 10 centimeters. But to you, it might appear to be merely 6 centimeters. Surely this is an illusion, you might say, because how could the same object have two different lengths? The atoms can't be compressed together for you, but not for me. Once again, we return to the question of what is real. If every measurement you can perform on my ruler tells you it is 6 centimeters long, then it is 6 centimeters long. Length is not an abstract quantity, but requires a measurement. Since measurement is observer-dependent, so is length. To see this as possible, while illuminating another of relativity's slippery catch-22s, consider one of my favorite examples. Say I have a car that is 12 feet long, and you have a garage that is 8 feet deep. My car will clearly not fit into your garage. But relativity implies that if I'm driving fast, you will measure my car to be only, say, 6 feet long. And so it should fit in your garage, at least while the car is moving. However, let's view this from my vantage point. For me, my car is 12 feet long, and your garage is moving toward me fast. And now it is measured by me to be not 8 feet deep, but rather 4 feet deep. Thus, my car clearly cannot fit in your garage. So which is true? Clearly, my car cannot be both inside of the garage and not inside the garage. Or can it? Let's first consider your vantage point and imagine that you have fixed big doors on the front of your garage and the back of your garage. So that I don't get killed while driving into it, you perform the following. You have the back door closed, but open the front door so my car can drive in. When it is inside, you close the front door. However, you then quickly open the back door before the front of my car crashes, letting me safely drive out of the back. Thus, you have demonstrated that my car was inside your garage, which of course it was, because it is small enough to fit in it. However, remember that for me, the time ordering of distant events can be different. Here's what I will observe. I will see your tiny garage heading toward me, and I will see you open the front door of the garage in time for the front of my car to pass through. I will then see you kindly open the back door before I crash. After that, and after the back of my car is inside the garage, I will see you close the front door of your garage. As will be clear to me, my car was never inside your garage with both doors closed at the same time, because that is impossible. Your garage is too small. Reality for each of us is simply based on what we can measure. In my frame, the car is bigger than the garage. In your frame, the garage is bigger than my car. Period. The point is that we can only be in one place at one time, and reality where we are is unambiguous. But what we infer about the real world in other places is based on remote measurements, which are observer-dependent. But the virtue of careful measurement does not stop there. The new reality that Einstein unveiled, based as it was on the empirical validity of Galileo's law and Maxwell's remarkable unification of electricity and magnetism, appears on its face to replace any last vestige of objective reality with subjective measurement. As Plato reminds us, however, the job of the natural philosopher is to probe deeper than this. It is said that fortune favors the prepared mind. In some sense, Plato's cave prepared our minds for Einstein's relativity, though it remained for Einstein's former mathematics professor, Hermann Minkowski, to complete the task. Minkowski was a brilliant mathematician, eventually holding a chair at the University of Göttingen. But in Zurich, where he was one of Einstein's professors, he was a brilliant mathematician whose classes Einstein skipped, because while he was a student, Einstein appeared to have a great disdain for the significance of pure mathematics. Time would change that view. Recall that the prisoners in Plato's cave also saw from shadows on their wall that length apparently had no objective constancy. The shadow of a ruler might at one time appear to be 10 centimeters, and another time appear to be 6 centimeters. The similarity with the example I presented when discussing relativity is intentional. In the case of Plato's cave dwellers, however, we recognized that this length contraction occurred because the cave dwellers were merely seeing two-dimensional shadows of an underlying three-dimensional object. Viewed from above, it can be seen that the shorter shadow projected on the wall results because the ruler has been rotated at an angle with respect to the wall. And, as another Greek philosopher, Pythagoras, taught us, when seen this way, the length of the ruler is fixed, but the projections onto the wall and a line perpendicular to the wall will always combine together to give the same length, as shown in the attached PDF, figure 5D. This yields the famous Pythagorean theorem. L squared equals X squared plus Y squared, which high school students have been subjected to for as long as high schools have taught geometry. In three dimensions, this becomes L squared equals X squared plus Y squared plus Z squared. 2 years after Einstein wrote his first paper on relativity, Minkowski recognized that perhaps the unexpected implications of the constancy of the speed of light and the new relations between space and time unveiled by Einstein might also reflect a deeper connection between the two. Knowing that a photograph, which we usually picture as a two-dimensional representation of a three-dimensional space, is really an image spread out in both space and time, Minkowski reasoned that observers who were moving relative to each other might be observing different three-dimensional slices of a four-dimensional universe, one in which space and time are treated on an equal footing. If we return to the ruler example in the case of relativity, where the ruler of the moving observer is measured to be shorter by the other observer than it would be in the frame in which it is at rest, we should also remember that for this observer, the ruler is also spread out in time. Events at either end that are simultaneous to the observer at rest with respect to the ruler are not simultaneous with the second observer. Minkowski recognized that one could accommodate this fact and all the others by considering that the different three-dimensional perspectives probed by each observer were in some sense different rotated projections of a four-dimensional space-time, where there exists an invariant four-dimensional space-time length that would be the same for all observers. The four-dimensional space, which we now call Minkowski space, is a little different from its 3D counterpart, in that time as a fourth dimension is treated slightly differently from the three dimensions of space, X, Y, and Z. The four-dimensional space-time length, which we can label as S, is not written, in analogy to the three-dimensional length, which we denoted by L in the figure 5D, as S squared equals X squared plus Y squared plus Z squared plus T squared, but rather as S squared equals X squared plus Y squared plus Z squared minus T squared. The minus sign that appears in front of T squared in the definition of space-time length S gives Minkowski space its special characteristics, and it is the reason our different perspectives of space and time when we are moving relative to one another are not simple rotations, as in the case of Plato's cave, but something a little more complicated. Nevertheless, in one fell swoop, the very nature of our universe had changed. As Minkowski poetically put it in 1908, quote, "Henceforth, space by itself and time by itself are doomed to fade away into mere shadows, and only a kind of union of the two will preserve an independent reality," end quote. Thus, on the surface, Einstein's special theory of relativity appears to make physical reality subjective and observer-dependent. But relativity is in this sense a misnomer. The theory of relativity is instead a theory of absolutes. Space and time measurements may be subjective, but space-time measurements are universal and absolute. The speed of light is universal and absolute. And four-dimensional Minkowski space is the field on which the game of nature is played. The depth of the radical change in perspective brought about by Minkowski's reframing of Einstein's theory can perhaps best be understood by considering Einstein's own reactions to Minkowski's picture. Initially, Einstein called it superfluous learnedness, suggesting that it was simply fancy mathematics, devoid of physical significance. Shortly thereafter, he emphasized this by saying, quote, "Since the mathematicians have invaded relativity theory, I do not understand it myself anymore," end quote. Ultimately, however, as happened several times in his lifetime, Einstein came around and recognized that this insight was essential to understand the true nature of space and time. And he later built his general theory of relativity on the foundation that Minkowski had laid. It would have been difficult, if not impossible, to guess that Faraday's spinning wheels and magnets would eventually lead to such a profound revision in our understanding of space and time. With the spectacles of hindsight, however, we could have had at least an inkling that the unification of electricity and magnetism could have heralded a world where motion would reveal a new underlying reality. Returning to Faraday and Maxwell, one of the important discoveries that started the ball rolling was that a magnet acts on a moving electric charge with an odd force. Instead of pushing the charge forward or backward, the magnet exerts a force always at right angles to the motion of the electric charge. This force, now called the Lorentz force, after Hendrik Lorentz, a physicist who came close to discovering relativity himself, can be pictured in the attached PDF 5E. The charge moving between the poles of the magnet gets pushed upward. But now consider how things would look from the frame of the particle. In its frame, the magnet would be moving past it, as can be seen in the attached PDF 5F. But, by convention, we think of an electrically charged particle at rest as being affected only by electric forces. Thus, since the particle is at rest in this frame, the force pushing the particle upward in this picture would be interpreted as an electric force. One person's magnetism is therefore another person's electricity, and what connects the two is motion. The unification of electricity and magnetism reflects at its heart that uniform relative motion gives observers different perspectives of reality. Motion, a subject first explored by Galileo, ultimately provided, 3 centuries later, a key to a new reality, one in which not only electricity and magnetism were unified, but also space and time. No one could have anticipated this saga at its beginning. But that is the beauty of the greatest story ever told. Chapter 6. The Shadows of Reality. As they were walking along and talking together, suddenly a chariot of fire and horses of fire appeared and separated the two of them. 2 Kings, chapter 2, verse 11. One might have thought that, in 1908, following the aftershock of the discovery of an unexpected hidden connection between space and time, nature couldn't have gotten much stranger. But the cosmos doesn't care about our sensibilities. And once again, light provided the key to the door of the rabbit hole to a world that makes Alice's experiences seem tame. While they may be strange, the connections unearthed by Einstein and Minkowski can be intuitively understood, given the constancy of the speed of light, as I've tried to demonstrate. Far less intuitive was the next discovery, which was that on very small scales, nature behaves in a way that human intuition cannot ever fully embrace, because we cannot directly experience the behavior itself. As Richard Feynman once argued, no one understands quantum mechanics. If by understand, one means developing a concrete physical picture that appears fully intuitive. Even many years after the rules of quantum mechanics were discovered, the discipline would keep yielding surprises. For example, in 1952, the astrophysicist Hanbury Brown built an apparatus to measure the angular size of large radio sources in the sky. It worked so well that he and a colleague, Richard Twiss, applied the same idea to try and measure the optical light from individual stars and determine their angular size. Many physicists claimed that their instrument, called an intensity interferometer, could not possibly work. Quantum mechanics, they argued, would rule it out. But it worked. It wasn't the first time physicists had been wrong about quantum mechanics, and it wouldn't be the last. Coming to grips with the strange behavior of quantum mechanics often means accepting the seemingly impossible. As Brown himself amusingly put it when trying to explain the theory of his intensity interferometer, he and Twiss were expounding the, quote, paradoxical nature of light, or if you like, explaining the incomprehensible, an activity closely and interestingly analogous to preaching the Athanasian Creed, end quote. Indeed, like many of the stranger effects in quantum mechanics, the Holy Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost all embodied at the same time in a single being, is also seemingly impossible. The similarity ends there, however. Common sense also tells us that light cannot be both a wave and a particle at the same time. However, in spite of what common sense suggests, and whether we like it or not, experiments tell us it is so. Unlike the Creed, developed in the 5th century, this fact is not a matter of semantics or choice or belief. So we don't need to recite quantum mechanics creeds every week to make them seem less bizarre or more believable. One hears about the interpretation of quantum mechanics for good reason, because the classical picture of reality, namely the picture given by Newton's laws of classical motion of the world as we experience it on human scales, is inadequate to capture the full picture. The surface world we experience hides key aspects of the process that underlie the phenomena we observe. So too, Plato's philosophers could not discover the biological processes that govern humans by observing just the shadows of humans on the wall. No level of analysis would be likely to allow them to intuit the full reality underlying the dark forms. The quantum world defies our notion of what is sensible, or even possible. It implies that at small scales and for short times, the simple classical behavior of macroscopic objects, baseballs, thrown from pitcher to catcher, for example, simply break down. Indeed, on small scales, objects are undergoing many different classical behaviors, as well as classically forbidden behaviors, at the same time. Quantum mechanics, like almost all of physics since Plato, began with scientists thinking about light. So it is appropriate to begin to explore quantum craziness by starting with light. In this case, by returning to an important experiment first reported by the British polymath Thomas Young around 1800, the famous double-slit experiment. Young lived in an era that is hard to appreciate today, when a brilliant and hard-working individual could make breakthroughs in a host of different fields. But Young was not just any brilliant, hard-working individual. He was a prodigy, reading at 2, and by the age of 13, he had read the major Greek and Latin epic poems, had built a microscope and a telescope, and was learning 4 different languages. Later, trained as a medical doctor, Young was the first to propose in 1806 the modern concept of energy, which now permeates every field of scientific endeavor. That alone would have made him memorable. But in his spare time, he was also one of the first to help decipher the hieroglyphics on the Rosetta Stone. He developed the physics of elastic materials, associated with what is now called Young's modulus, and helped first elucidate the physiology of color vision. And his brave demonstration of the wave nature of light, which argued against Isaac Newton's powerful claim that light was made of particles, was so compelling that it helped lay the basis of Maxwell's discovery of electromagnetic waves. Young's experiment is simple. Let's return to Plato's cave and consider a screen placed in front of the back wall of a cave. Place 2 slits in the screen, as shown in the attached PDF, figure 6A. If the light is made of particles, then those light rays that pierce the slits would form 2 bright lines on the wall behind these 2 slits, as shown in the attached PDF, figure 6B. However, it is well known that waves, unlike particles, diffract around barriers and narrow slits and would produce a very different pattern on the wall. If waves impinge on the barrier, and if each slit is narrow, a circular pattern of waves is generated at each slit.